And now it's time for On Our Minds. With massive protests in Ferguson, Missouri this week over the shooting of unarmed teenager Michael Brown, we've been thinking about how prevalent that toxic combination of racial conflict and police violence is in America. A young sociologist named Alice Goffman has just written a remarkable and somewhat controversial book on the subject. It's called On the Run, and it's based on her long-term ethnographic study of young black men in Philadelphia. Now, Goffman is white, and when she began her research, she was a student at the University of Pennsylvania. She moved off campus and into a poor black neighborhood downtown, where she lived for the next 6 years, commuting between the Ivy League and the inner city. Steve Paulson recently sat down with Goffman to talk about how constant police surveillance has shaped the lives of the young men who became some of her closest friends.
So tell me about some of these guys you met and got to know very well, Mike and Chuck. What kind of lives did they lead?
So Chuck, I met him when he was 18. He's Mike's really good friend, and they grew up together in this neighborhood that I call Sixth Street. And I met him when he was sitting in county jail on trial for an aggravated assault charge. And I met him by starting to go with Mike to visit him in county jail. He had made it all the way through high school without any jail time, which he was super proud of. He had made it to 18. And in his senior year of high school, he got into a fight in the schoolyard with a kid who had called his mom a crack whore. And he pushed the kid's face into the snow, and then the school cops charged him with aggravated assault. So he had this aggravated assault charge, and since he was 18, he was in the adult system. So he was pulled out of school and had this pending trial going for 8 months of his senior year while he sat in county jail, and he couldn't make the bail because he couldn't afford it. So at the end of that, almost all the charges were dismissed. He just had to pay like a couple $100 in court fees. So then he spent the summer at home, didn't get into any trouble, tried to re-enroll again as a senior the next year, and the secretary told him that he couldn't enroll because he was 19 and that was too old. So like then he was a high school dropout, and then he couldn't pay the court fees that came due after his case ended. So then he had a bench warrant out for the court fees. So then he was a fugitive. And that's like the kind of point of the book. It's like, it's not just that the United States is now massively imprisoning African-American young men and returning them home with felony convictions. It's that there's this whole underside of the criminal justice system that's much less visible, that's about surveillance and policing, and that is creating a kind of fugitive life, not just for guys with warrants, but for people on probation or parole, young men living in neighborhoods like this who are worried that any moment they will be seized.
So it sounds like you're saying that there can be what would seem to be fairly minor incidents that totally change someone's life, and basically that change their lives in a direction that then becomes trafficking outside the legal system.
Yeah, so Tim's first arrest, Tim is Chuck's youngest brother. There's three brothers, Chuck, Reggie, and Tim. And Tim's first arrest came when he was 11. His older brother, Chuck, was driving him to school in his girlfriend's car, and the cops stopped them, ran the tags, and the car came up as stolen in California. So they charged Chuck with receiving stolen property, and they charged his younger brother, Tim, age 11, with accessory to receiving stolen property. So then he was placed on probation, which then he violated later for another very small thing. So that's what set him down the path. Mike, Chuck's very good friend, his first arrest came at 13 when he was stopped and searched and found in possession of a very small amount of marijuana. You know, at the same time that I was living in this neighborhood and writing notes every day about what the police were doing and the level of surveillance and arresting, I was also like commuting to Penn and then Princeton for class. So then I got to watch this whole other group of men who were also young men and also getting into different things like
drugs. You probably saw a lot of the kids at the University of Penn smoking pot too, and
yeah,
they
not
probably
just pot,
never faced
like
any
much harder drugs like at frat parties. Yeah, so it was amazing to me to see the contrast, like not very many blocks away. Here are all these mostly white students, elite students on college campuses, and there's drugs and there's drunk driving and there's fights and there's rape, and these kids are graduating with degrees in English and business and sociology and not felony convictions. The kind of racial politics of this country are fraught. And the thing is like, it's not because there's a level of crime that is that is like over and above what's happening in lots of other neighborhoods. It's really about changes in policing and imprisonment. So beginning in the late 1970s, the United States started this massive social experiment in punishment. And this wasn't punishment leveled like across the population. It was really targeted at Black and also Latino communities. So the level of policing in Mike and Chuck's neighborhood was a different world from anything I had seen in the white neighborhood that I had grown up in or on Penn's campus.
One of the things you write about is how a lot of these guys, even if they got really hurt, I mean, pistol whipped, even shot, they would do anything to avoid going to the hospital, going to the ER, because they were worried the cops might catch them there.
Yeah, in the first few years of doing this research, I would just hang out in the ER and watch the police walk Black men in handcuffs out of the ER. It was like an amazingly great place to make their stats, to find people to arrest. You know, the police are an occupying force. Like 52 times in the first 18 months, I watched the police raid houses, chase people through houses, break down doors. I think like 14 times I watched the police punch, choke, beat, stomp on, beat with their nightsticks young men after they had chased them down and cuffed them in the street.
You had seen this personally.
Yeah. Yeah. I was taking notes every day. I was taking field notes every day. So you have to learn how to run. You have to learn when the police are coming, and you have to learn how to run from them. And you have to learn what the undercovers look like, and you have to learn who else around you may have a warrant or may have heat on them for various reasons, and then who to avoid. And it's this whole strategy of negotiating everyday life so that you can run at a moment. You have to learn where to hide.
Did you find yourself having to run?
Yes. The first time I really remember, I walked up to Chuck's house, and Chuck and Reggie were both home from prison and jail that year, and Chuck came running out of the house and said, like, the cops are coming. And I think Reggie had a warrant during that time. So Chuck took off, and Reggie too, and they were like, come on, let's go. So we ran through the neighborhood, and I remember getting very out of breath, and like, I was not used to running like that. And then I lost them, and then I heard them through the doorway of this woman whose house I had never been to before in the neighborhood. And she was like this very church-going, wonderfully proper woman. And they were upstairs in her boudoir. She had this amazing dressing room. Who knew? She was like a huge clothes horse. So we were up there waiting out the cops, you know.
But I have to say that this takes participant observation study to extremes here. The fact that,
not really.
You're on the run too.
No, because the police were totally ignoring me most of the time. Like, I only got pulled in for questioning like twice in all those years. Like, most of the time, like, that's the thing, right? It's very race-based. So like, they're not interested in white women. Like, they are not interested in women as much as men, and white women, like, almost not at all. So like, I was almost invisible to the police a lot of the time, or like, so many times I would be like outside with a group of guys, and then the police would stop and search every single person, and I would just still be sitting there, and the police just wouldn't bother me at all. So it's like they had a totally different way of treating white and Black people. But the other thing too is, like, when you talk about participant observation, like, if you're interested in learning about waitresses, you get a job as a waitress. So this was participant observation light, because I never sold drugs, I never got arrested, I never went to prison, I never caught cases.
You've talked about how you saw a lot of things, saw violence by the police, by other people. You saw a couple of murders, didn't you?
I was once in a crowd of people and watched the police strangle someone who died. And there was talk in the family about suing the police department, and that didn't get off the ground. I was in a car when a guy who I actually didn't know, he was getting out of my car and was shot, and I didn't know if he died or not, and everybody ran, including me.
This book is getting a lot of attention now and a lot of praise. It's, among other things, just a remarkable feat of reporting. You've also gotten some criticism. And one of the lines of criticism is that because you saw so much, you became very close friends with some of these people you were hanging out with, and you witnessed a fair amount of violence. Were you ever complicit? How do you sort that out?
So the question really is, like, how do you do morally responsible work with a vulnerable group of people who are in a state of legal precariousness on questions of pressing moral urgency? how do you do that work ethically? How do you report on what is happening in corners of the country that have very little voice in mainstream politics ethically and responsibly? And I think that it's not a kind of how-to manual. It's just what I did. And I think every day I was struggling with these ethical issues, and I continue to struggle with them, and I don't think I have any answers. I do think that it's important to bear witness and to do that in a way that honors the people that I got to know.
Near the end of your book, you talk about something really tragic that happened. One of the men you'd become very close to, Chuck, was killed. Can you describe what happened?
Yeah, Chuck was the peacemaker in the group. He spent a lot of time trying to mend the fences. So there'd been this dispute between the 6th Street boys and the 4th Street boys. And Chuck had been someone who was really kind of going between the groups and trying to squash the beef. He saw a guy from 4th Street outside of the Chinese store. I wasn't there, but his girlfriend was nearby and said what she thinks happened is that he saw the guy saw him, the guy kind of made a move, Chuck made a move. Chuck didn't even have a gun on him, but the guy thought he might have, and then this guy shot him in the head. So I got the call from Mike saying Chuck's been shot in the head, and I had seen Chuck like the day before, I think. So I went to get Mike from the suburbs. We went to the hospital together. When we drove in, there were like 30 guys from the neighborhood standing watch outside of the ER, like holding this vigil for Chuck. And I remember feeling really awkward as a white woman coming into the scene in downtown Philly, where it was clear like I wasn't really welcome to stand on the corner with all of his friends and neighbors and sort of stand watch, but I didn't. So I walked into the hospital and asked at the desk like what was happening, and they looked at me and then looked at the file and were like, "Do you actually know him?" And I was like, "Yes, he's my cousin." So then the cops cleared everybody off the sidewalk, and at that point everybody else had gone. So then I kind of like with all my whiteness, like managed to get through the various people at the hospital and get to Chuck's room, which none of his friends were permitted to do. So, which also is like a dilemma, right? It's like, should I be here? I'm here on the basis of my whiteness. Anyway, so I'm like sitting outside of this room, and he's got tubes, and there's a TV on. It looks like he's watching it, but his face is swollen and his head is bandaged, and I don't know what's happening at that point. So I just sat there outside of the ER for many hours, and then it was like a code blue. So then all these doctors came rushing in, and the bullet like had split into his brain. So then I had to call his mom and say, actually, I think I passed the phone to the doctor, and then she told his mom, or somebody there told his mom, that he was not going to make it. And then I sat with him until his girlfriend came. His youngest brother, Tim, was pulled in for questioning because Tim had been really close by when he was killed. So Tim couldn't be there either. So we just sat there in the hospital with him, like as his body grew stiff. And so, yeah, I got to be there with him when he died.
Wow. If there's one thing that that you'd want people to take away from your book, what would it be?
So a great juvenile detention reformer, Bart Lubow, in a speech he gave a couple months ago, talked about the insatiable thirst for punishment in American society and insatiable thirst for punishing black boys and men. And I think the way the criminal justice system is currently operating, we're asking young people who are facing the most challenges in the labor market, who have the fewest resources, with the least amount of education, living in neighborhoods where violence is an everyday threat. We're asking these young people to walk the tightest possible line, to walk a line way tighter than the one any of the rest of us are asked to walk. And why are we not providing support to young people facing these challenges? Why are we offering handcuffs and jail time and this fugitive existence? We've got to turn this around.
That's Alice Goffman. She's the author of On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. She spoke with Steve Paulson.